Hello, everyone. I know you're used to hearing my voice on Mondays, but we decided to release part two of our two-part episode with Penn's Sunday School a bit early this week and bring you a brand new episode on Monday. And if you're like me, you can use a little extra at-home entertainment right now. I hope this conversation helps. And once again, I'll remind you that this episode was taped back in February, which explains why we aren't discussing the coronavirus or its profound impact on Las Vegas. Now, here is part two of my chat with the great Penn Jillette.
When I used to play Little League, which I played, my dad would go and sit in the stands and go, see the kid out in left field doing nothing? That's my son.
I am on the prowl indeed. Welcome to Podcats. This is Cats, John Katzlamitas of the Las Vegas Review Journal. My column is called Cats, fittingly enough. Find it on page 3A every day and online all the time. This week we have part two of our two-part crossover extravaganza with Penn's Sunday School. If you missed part one of this episode, I suggest you hit pause, go back, and listen to last week's episode before continuing on with this one. Now on to the rest of my conversation with Penn Jillette and Michael Godot of Penn's Sunday School.
So when I have people coming to Vegas and they ask me what show to see, I say, of course, Mack King.
Yes.
And so. Piff. Mm-hmm. And what shows do you you recommend?
Those two. Absinthe is still one of my favorite shows. I love Atomic over at Atomic Saloon Show over at... at the Venetian, at the Grand Canal Shops on the second floor Atomic Saloon, they call it now.
Beautiful room.
Yeah, it's really great cool. Room. You know, Spiegelworld's really good at architecture, at matching. You know, they're good at matching their ideas to architecture. Yeah, they're really good at that. I like Opium a lot. You know, under the kernels under the in the popcorn, I'm still a big fan of Zombie Burlesque. Over at V Theater.
That's been going forever.
Yeah, it's been 6 years, I think. They've passed 6.5 years. A dynamite show for, pound for pound, very, very good show. I like Tape Face a lot.
Yeah.
I really think that's a very underrated show still. Piff is so good, too. You know, those are the kinds of things I like watching. You know, I like and a good, I like a good also, showman, too.
Piff
you know?
Is also another one of the rare shows that's changing all the time.
Yeah, Piff, you know, absolutely.
Piff
yeah.
and I get together about once a week, and we pull out our notebooks.
Uh-huh.
And Piff says, these are the things I'm working on, and I give him jokes. And I say, this is the things I'm working on, and Piff throws that stuff in there.
Yeah, I like him so much. I do. I really appreciate John, him in and out of character. I'll plug Santa Fe and the Fat City Horns at Copper Room, by the way. Lon Bronson's All-Star Band is one of my favorite things to see. Frankie Marino's puts on a terrific show down at South Point and at Cabaret Jazz. You can never see him. I just saw Michael Grimm the other day. He's amazing. Piff, I learned a lot about Piff when he told me how he golfs. I asked him about golfing because he was asking if I golf, and I said, I golf, but I'm not currently a golfer, if that makes sense. I own clubs, but I have to dust them off.
Yeah.
And in fact, I talked to Emily about actually giving lessons to get back in the game. You know, we're talking about golf. I go, you golf? And he goes, yeah. And I go, what do you shoot? And
she'll be playing golf with Bill Murray this week coming up. That's her golf.
Emily's
day.
Playing golf with Bill Murray.
Yeah, up in San Francisco. She's going up to meet him and play golf.
Is it tied to an event? Or just
it's tied to some sort of charity event that they'll be doing together.
He's a handful on the course.
But they will be playing.
I got to talk
together.
To her about this. He's supposed to be really interesting to golf with.
Well, I've known Bill for a while.
All right.
I don't know him.
Has
well.
He seen your show here?
I don't think so. No.
Wow.
No. But I met him in New York. We've been backstage together, hosting stuff and going out and doing awards things.
He spun a woman into the bunker in the AT&T Pro-Am years ago. He was dancing with a woman on the course, and he took her and he spun her around, and he spun her, and she went into the sand trap.
What's the penalty for that?
Yeah, you could take. I think, what was his line? I think I'll take a drop, and so will she. Yeah, but anyway, yeah, Piff was telling me that he golfed, you know, and I'm like, what do you shoot? That's a common, you know, what's your handicap, or do you have a handicap, or where do you like to play? What do you, you know, what is your score? My line is usually at my bowling score and my golf score are about the same, so 130. And he says, I don't have one. I go, well, what do you shoot? He goes, I don't keep score. And I go, well, you do golf. He goes, yeah. I go, okay. How does one golf? You don't keep track of your score? No. I hit, and if I don't like that shot, I won't find the ball. I'll just go back out, and I'll hit from about the sun, or I'll go to the ball, and I'll hit again, and I'll hit again. And if I get tired of it, I'll just go to the next hole. Until he golfs, until there's emotional fatigue, and then he'll go to the next tee block. Now, that is the kind of golf I can play. When I go back out on the course, I will golf with him, and we'll have that round. Bring a lot of balls.
I could not love that more.
That is so freaking authentic, man.
Love that more.
He told me that, I go, even people who would do that, I don't know anybody who does do that, actually.
Right.
Probably don't talk all about it. They just, you know, that's just their way of but that's he's a proponent of that.
Oh, that's
so he can. And this is a guy who probably played Shadow Creek or anywhere he wants, and he's out there slapdicking it around, not keeping score. And you know
what I, you know, my family, back as far as I can tell, generations and continuing on into the future, no interest whatsoever in sports.
That's
none.
Yeah. Okay.
None. And when I used to play Little League, which I played, my dad would go and sit in the stands and go, see the kid out in left field doing nothing? That's my son. And he'll get up and he'll just strike out. He doesn't
left
care.
Out.
Look at him daydreaming out there. Mm-hmm. My dad just had nothing. And I remember when I did Dancing with the Stars, right?
I do.
Mm-hmm. And first one thrown off.
Yeah. You were with Kim Johnson, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I remember that.
And I went up in front of the judges and did the jokes. And I went backstage. And there was a moment where they said, we're doing the what do they call it? The confessionals afterwards, when they do the backstage.
Oh, yeah. The testimony.
So I'm sitting there with Kim, and they say, what'd you think of our score? What'd you think of your score? And I said, what was our score? And they went, what'd you think about what the judges said? I said, well, I got two jokes in that seemed okay. And I said, one of the things they did just kind of didn't land. And they said, what'd you think of how you did? I said, how'd we do? And there was this amazing thing in the room where there was no, they could not comprehend the fact that I did not walk backstage with the score ringing in my head.
Why did you do that show, by the way? I was wondered why you would be on Dancing with the Stars.
Just selling tickets. That's my job. Okay. That's my only job.
So you just wanted to be on national TV to
plug it? Yeah, didn't matter at all.
Okay.
Well, here's the thing about sports that baseball is not like this, but golf is like this, and it's snacks with friends, with some physical trick that you do.
Yeah, I guess.
You know what I mean? I'm not a golfer, but I enjoy hitting a golf ball because it goes a really long way.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's just funny.
Exactly. Yeah,
and I have snacks and I laugh, and I've gone golfing with, you know, with Mac King, and we just laugh and drive around, and it's sunny outside. It's not a game.
Don't try to tell my wife that.
I understand.
I've seen her hit, but man. I mean, she's legit. She's so good.
You know what I mean? It's what I think about baseball. Baseball is high tea with just a tiny bit of entertainment. I love going and sitting for 3 hours with my friends with nothing else to do except chat.
Yeah.
I got to go to high tea then.
Yeah.
I don't do enough high tea.
High tea is exactly that.
Okay.
Yeah, well, without anybody making noise.
High tea was, we used to go to the Waldorf Astoria.
Oh, that was
me,
so fun.
Me, Gilbert Gottfried. Oh,
man. Okay.
Sometimes Al Goldstein. You know, pornographer. Uh-huh. We would go to high tea at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. These all these finely dressed old ladies, and then this table of loud, nutty dirt balls, eating little sandwiches and drinking the tea. Because we're all non-drinkers,
mm-hmm.
So that was our way of hanging out at a bar.
We, you know, Gilbert, he was that guy when he was at the Hilton. Remember, he did his residency run. He was known to just hang out at the hotel, just hang out. And he'd bring his lunch up to the executive offices, like, you know, the GM's office, just walk in and sit down, and they'd be on, you know, on the phone or on a conference call. He'd just sit there and, you know, eat his sandwich.
He did not bring his lunch. he made them get him lunch.
Well, he's having lunch.
Having lunch. Yes.
Having his lunch brought to
That's
him.
Why he was there, was to get the free lunch. Okay. I'm trying to explain to you what was going on.
Oh.
He would show up every noon.
So sitting on the conference call is a small price to pay for the free Reuben.
Right. Exactly. That's what he was trying to get.
Thank you for clarifying that. I knew I could count it.
I remember going to Carnegie Deli, which I used to go to with Gilbert all the time, and Sandy, who was the owner of Carnegie Deli. Uh-huh. I remember him coming to our table furious and saying, I can't believe, Penn, you come down here from Massachusetts to a Jewish deli and you order corned beef with mayonnaise on white bread. And he was making a big scene, and Gilbert went, that was me. He got corned beef on rye with mustard. Me. I'm not Jewish enough for you. That's the problem. So I was protected. But yes, there were two orders. There were two orders that went in. One was corned beef with mayonnaise on white bread, and that was the guy from Brooklyn.
Well, that order then was known in those days as the photon torpedo at Quark's then, because I think that's what he was eating. when they had the Star Trek experience, that's how long ago. That is going back.
That's going back.
That's when he was hanging out there.
But we used to have high tea. But yeah, so I have never been, so we did Dance with the Stars. Mm-hmm. When Glenn really took over our organization, he said, we've got to be on TV. And I was really bad at it at first, but Glenn's job was, this is such a complicated thing to talk about now because of what's happened in our country. But if we can put that aside, put aside the State of the Union we just saw and the impeachment, put all that aside for a moment. When I did Celebrity Apprentice, we doubled our ticket sales.
Yeah.
Doubled.
This is your first appearance.
Yeah. Doubled.
I get it.
And continued to double for 5 years.
That show was a phenomenon. Boom. And and your run with Adkins was really, really interesting to follow. The final.
And Annie Duke, the poker player, who'd been on the year before me, she said to me, I said, I'm going to go on the Celebrity Apprentice thing. What is it going to be? And she said, two things to keep in mind. One, you will have your heart broken because you will watch people cheat and lose.
Wow.
And she said, that is the most painful thing I've ever experienced. Because she said, I can accept people cheating and winning, and I can accept people playing fair and losing.
Uh-huh.
But she said, you will not be emotionally prepared for desperate people to lie and cheat and backstab and still lose.
And what do you think of your affiliation with that brand and the whole thing now? I mean,
I said to her, wow. And then I was there watching it going, it is really one of the most depressing things you can experience. And you don't get to see it much. And the other thing she said is, have one goal on the show, one goal only. And I said, what should mine be? And she said, try going on and thinking about nothing except showing America that atheists can be kind.
Okay.
She said, nothing else. She said,
well, that's not hard for you to
sell. Selling the tickets will take care of itself, everything else. And they told me, the producers told me, that at the end of the run, they believed I was the only person who they ever had on the show that they never caught in a lie.
Wow.
Because, you know, they run mics all the time.
Yeah.
And also, everybody else, you know, seemed so terrified the whole time. But yes, being associated with that brand, I was...
Yeah, how's that right now for you?
Very good that I didn't win, because now somehow that's being spun by people who interview me as I wasn't completely involved or something. I mean, losing ended up being a good thing, which is there's no truth to that.
You won, but got screwed unfairly. That's almost better than winning and cheating. But it is better than winning.
Oddly enough.
But,
Who knew that sort of thing would happen?
I mean,
in a game show.
Donald Trump Jr. said to me a sentence that haunts me. He said to me, "You're the only one who's been on this show who seems to like my father. You seem to like him." And I said, "Well, you know, I always like people who are outside of the bell curve.
Yeah.
I like people who don't fit in." And I said, and I said this a zillion times, I said, for his job, Donald Trump is really good at this. He's a really good coworker because you want someone who's capricious and arbitrary, and you want someone who you can't understand what they're thinking.
This is as the host of Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice.
I said, you want that. I said, if you had Bill Gates for this show, it's a totally uninteresting show because Bill just makes the right decisions, right?
And if he were to take on a different personality, it would be so obvious.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, but Warren Buffett, you know, it would not be the same.
But, you know, they came to me when I was at the final thing with Trace, you know, the final show. And they went backstage and they said, Donald Trump is considering a run for president. Are you going to be supporting him? And I said, well, no. He would be a very, very bad president. And they said, well, he really wants to know before he makes his decision if you're
going
to support him.
Going back that far, huh?
Yeah. Okay. Wow. And I said, well, no, I won't support him as president. I think he does fine on this show, but this is not what we want.
It sounds like you look at Trump the way I look at some shows. Yeah. You know, when you talk about, you know, one way or the other, it's possible to find a more than an absolutely complicated opinion of something.
No, but you're going to be working, you know, it's a 6-week period. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go all the way, which I did
ideally
virtually both times, 4 to 6 week period where you're going to be working with somebody. You know, when I was a dishwasher at Howard Johnson's, you find a way to get along with your coworkers. So Donald Trump was not someone whose company I ever sought. We could have had our paths crossed. I never sought him out.
The first time I noticed his Twitter idiosyncrasies was as a result of you guys when I was back there and you had opened.
There was,
and he started coming after you then.
Because there was a time, and I say this all the time, but it's stunning. There was a time when the New York Times printed the people Trump hates most, his hate list, and I was number 7, and I was above Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think at the time he deserved to be above Hillary Clinton.
And, you know, it was astonishing because what I said was, what Trump hated me for, it was an amazing sentence because now I look back on it and I feel like coward for what I said. I do not feel like I attacked him. I said I will not support him for president because it's a different skill set than show business. Mm-hmm. And then I said this sentence, which everybody ignored, and I'm kind of glad because I said, there's nobody that I respect more in the world than Teller. There's no one I trust more than Teller. But if he were running for president, I would not support him. Mm-hmm. That's not tools for the job.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I actually said. And that's what Trump hated me for. Simply saying I wouldn't support him. And I always compare it to Al Franken. You know?
Right.
Al Franken, when he's first running for the Senate, asked me if I'd endorse him. And I wrote back and said, you know, Al, you're honest. I'm going to leave out all the Me Too stuff because I don't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. But this is at the time he's running for Senate. So years before that. I said, you're a good guy. You're an honest guy. You're really, really smart. You really know all this stuff. I consider you a friend. I really, really like you. Our political views are different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'd feel good about supporting you. And he wrote back, thank you so much for your honesty. But to go back to entertainment in Vegas, as opposed to the Trump stuff, which is whatever I'm going to say about Trump, others are saying it better. What do you think? What is your opinion of all the lip syncing?
I think you're living You're living in denial if you don't think shows are tracked to some level. There isn't some augmentation of vocals in any show, because it's just, it's too, first of all, it's too difficult to
not
sing.
Tom Jones.
When's the last time he played here?
You know,
been
a while.
It's been, yeah, it was the Hollywood Theater.
Yeah.
Pre-David Copperfield. I think it was in 07, maybe.
That's been a while.
So it has been a while. But I saw a special, it was a PBS special about him recently, and he still sounds damn good.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really. So, you know. And I think that,
not like Robert Plant taking stuff down a third so he can hit the notes.
Yeah, there's a
Tom's hitting everything.
Yeah, I know.
You did mention Lon Bronson.
What's that?
You said you did mention Lon Bronson.
Is he tracked?
He's not tracked.
Vocally? I think Lon's tracked in life. I think he's just, I kid. But I do think that if you see a show that has a, you know, obviously extensive choreography and there's somebody spinning around on stage and you've seen enough, entertainment and you don't hear any vocal balances, that is probably there's some, that the term is called, it's not straight lip syncing that I can detect all the time. It's what, there's a term called you might know this, it's called audio ducking, where it's a quality where I think I have this right, where you're singing to an existing track, but the technology allows that when you sing louder, your voice takes over the track. And you're singing over the track in your own voice more. There's a mix of percentages. Like I'm 60% tracked. I'm 40% tracked. That's how it's been explained to me. Like Janet Jackson did this. So audio ducking, I mean, that's one way it's been explained to me. I've looked it up. There is a
term called ducking.
Yeah.
And
ducking.
And you drive one source into compression with another source.
Yes. And I, that first came up when I did, it happened to be Janet Jackson, but there have been other shows. I think Jennifer Lopez was another one I noticed. Her voice in there, but not fully. So I think it's not going away. Mm-hmm. I think there's tracking not only vocally, but in terms of musicianship that's widespread in Las Vegas. Like I go to...
Paula Abdul's show, there wasn't even a...
100% tracked.
Yeah, it wasn't even a band.
Yeah. Oh, well, Backstreet Boys too.
Yeah.
Completely tracked dance show. So I mean, what do you do about this?
There's no moral issue. If people are having a good time, that's it.
That's usually where it lands.
Yeah, that's all.
That's usually all there can where be. It lands.
I mean, I have to, as a magician, believe that whatever you do to make people happy in your show is justified. There's no. There's some people that try to bring a moral element to it. Like if you're going to be on stage, you have to be singing.
Don't lie to us. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's always consumer driven, this stuff, by the way. You know, if the public were involved and they saw a show, like I'll bring up Diana Ross. When she opened at the Venetian, she had a horn section. She had, I think, four players. She had her regular sax guy and three Las Vegas players. Next time I saw her, just the sax. Mm-hmm. But I still was hearing a full horn section.
Yeah.
For my buddies from, you know, the guys who play with Lon or Santa Fe, yeah. They're still in the show, but not physically, you know what I mean? And I'm like, why in the world would Diana Ross need to track three horns? She's worth $80 million or whatever,
you know,
worth a fortune. She can afford it. And that's the kind of thing. And I think the reason is you have more control over the performance as a headliner. When you're primarily tracked.
You don't have to have them backstage.
You don't have to have them backstage.
Who wants a trumpet player backstage?
Yeah. No.
The trumpet player's not complaining about the chilled fizzy water, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's my answer would be it's a component of entertainment that has become so widespread that it's almost not even noteworthy. And that will be until such time that somebody's so freaking obvious about it that it detracts from the entertainment experience. And
well,
we have
not
seen that happen.
I have been pitching to tell her that we need to do a lip sync bit in our show.
It'd be brilliant.
With either me doing the vocal all on track or Teller doing a vocal on track.
That would be really good.
We don't know which we're ever going to do it, but we're talking about that. But I'm going to say this. I'm going to ask you. You will know who I'm talking about. But I don't want you to say who I'm talking about, okay?
I think I can do that.
There's now talk. I haven't seen the show yet.
Okay.
But there's now talk that there are magicians doing lip syncing by showing their close up and running video of their close up while they move their hands on the table.
No.
Yes,
really.
Yes,
pre-recorded item.
Okay, let me see about this. They're on the black felt, in other words.
Right.
Okay. And the video
and the camera
is cameras there. In front of them.
Yep.
And I'm going to do my card trick.
Right.
And the iMag is pre-recorded.
Just
tilt that table
and then
back
they play that
half an inch,
and I say something to the effect of, "Are you prepared?" And what you're seeing has been loaded.
Pre-recorded. And they're moving their hands, kind of, but they're not really doing the tricks that you're seeing up on the screen.
And it's Mike Close's hands.
Well, there was a magician who was caught like 15 years ago running video of someone else's hands doing the trick.
Well, I anticipate, I have not heard this, first of all. I can imagine who it might be. I hope that the entertainer in question, the magician in question, has used the hands of someone who is of the same ethnicity.
Yeah, I believe in this case, okay. It is that actual.
Okay, that's important. Hands. Let's just get that
established. Person's hands.
Oh, I got to go do some. I got to go scout some shows.
And we did a joke about that in the original. You know, we did Magic Goes Wrong. We had a lot of tryouts. We had a lot of out of town stuff, and I was over there doing that. So there's been for Magic Goes Wrong, which is a 2-hour show. There's probably been about 2 hours and 45 minutes that we've done. And one of the things we did was doing the close-up magic lip sync. We did that gag with a very broad physical gag with the table falling down and the magic still going on perfectly as the person tries
and
to
that's,
still lip sync.
I like it.
That was inspired by the fact the magicians have started doing that.
Okay. Well, that wouldn't be the first time something like that has inspired a moment in your show. I love the street magic, as you know, in your show. I love the street magic. I want to be in street magic. I want to be a character in street magic. I love that bit so much.
Yeah, we
it hits me on every level.
We had a lot of fun with that. But there are people that I have that have admitted doing that in their show. And I just kind of go, wow, that's crazy. Because we did a bit about that. Also, 20 years ago, we did a bit about lip syncing hand stuff.
Well, you've blown the cover off people or pulled the covers off people in your show before. Would you go to that level with this?
Well, I said we did it.
I mean, in your stage show,
we did it jokingly in our stage show before people did it for real. I mean, 20 years ago, we did a version of that. So we've already. We just thought it was impossible that someone would really do it.
Maybe you inspired it.
It had to do that.
But, you know, I remember.
I just got to not kick the table over. And this will work great.
Just need to refine it a little bit.
Better table.
You know, I mean, but the thing is, there's that difference between a track date. You know, I used to, when I was hanging out with Debbie Harry an awful lot, she would have some dates with the band and some track dates, which were all the essentially Debbie Harry doing karaoke, right?
Yeah.
She brings that up. And, but she always sang the vocals because Debbie's an incredible live singer. She's always dead on. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting now that the scandal that was Milli Vanilli could not happen now. I mean, it's because now it's 100%, right?
And
I mean,
it shouldn't have happened then.
Right, of course.
But it goes all the way back to Wrecking Crew and Danny's documentary on his dad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Wrecking Crew was those bands weren't playing, you know.
I don't know that it's. I don't think it's 100%, but I think it's more. I think it's more universal in at various levels than it's ever been. You know, like I go to you know, and you can kind of figure it out. Like I go, like Lady Gaga's jazz and piano show. She's live all the way through.
Yeah,
and she brings up the fact if they're bringing up the fact on stage that other people are lip syncing when they blow them up, like Elton John has done that too. I'm pretty confident they're not doing it because they're confident enough to take on people.
You know? There you go. But
that's going to be a good catch, though.
That's
yeah, but if you do catch, yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's a magician thinking.
Story. Yeah.
That's a magician. If I were lip syncing, I would certainly bust other people on it. this is the
that's
age of
why.
Trump.
Uh-huh.
That's why I bring it up.
Oh, the projection of the lip syncing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard that Elton's going to be coming back here anyway and over time, so we'll have to keep an eye on him. I think he's going to do a residency here.
I was disappointed with that show so much because I had heard nothing but how great Elton John was live, and I'd never seen them live.
Did you see him in which version of it? Did you see Red Piano or Million Dollar Piano? Did you see the later version?
I saw the earlier one,
like the Red Piano one.
Yeah.
Elton's show was all about. I thought Elton had the best show in town when Elton was interested. Too often, he just didn't seem like he was interested.
He didn't seem like he was paying attention at all.
Yeah, it was Groundhog Day,
and the music was all. Just it was not to track. It was all live, mm-hmm. but it was the arrangements were exactly off the records, which I guess is what people want, you know?
He always said it was Groundhog Day, you know? That's why when he's on tour, he plays three-hour shows just to, you know, get out of that pocket. But yeah, I know what you mean. I know. I saw him when he was, the night where he threw the water all over the stage, he got upset. And,
what happened?
He had a problem with, I forget what, and he was drinking water and he started flipping it around the stage because he was having a monitor problem, I think it was. There was some audio issue with him. And he got pissed off and skulked off and then came back on and everything was fine. But it was just like this odd vibe in the middle of the show that was totally unnecessary. And he was known to be temperamental about that type of thing. But when he was locked in and the show was running and you had all the production elements in place, I thought it was awesome.
That's what I always heard.
Yeah.
I heard nothing but good about Elton John. You know the one that I am the outlier on, I'm a complete outlier on this, was Prince.
At the Rio?
I saw Prince at the Rio, but I also saw Prince at Radio City or some like big, important show in New York. And I liked Prince and I had heard it was the greatest live show ever. And I saw Prince twice and neither time did he kill me. The Rio, I didn't think it was great.
Really?
And Radio City wasn't great. And I was like, what's wrong with me? What am I missing here? What am I missing here? Because I really wanted to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And maybe my hopes too high. And also with Elton John, I want to be destroyed. And also seeing The Who here, you know, and I know Roger, and I couldn't believe that Zach Starkey, when they're doing something that Keith Moon played drums on, and there's a mistake on the record, that Zach did the mistake. You know, during, Won't Get Fooled Again, during the drum break, when he comes back in, there's the two hits of the kick drum that Keith was out of time. And when Zach did that, I was like, what? So there's a different issue than playing to track. There's also the issue, which was with Elton John, is when you go see Paul Simon, we're not even going to bring in Dylan. Because Dylan, you're going to see a show that only existed that night.
Right.
You're always going to see that.
Right.
Dylan is there in a way that's a kind of artist that maybe we've got one alive at any given time, you know, and that's Bob. Okay, Bob, you're great. But Paul Simon, I guess he's retired now. But when you went to see Paul Simon, there were different arrangements of everything, you know? If you were going to do The Boxer, you were going to do You Can Call Me Al, different instrumentation, different stuff, just playing around. So you got that wonderful buzz of familiarity coupled with new ideas in there.
Yeah, that show, you have to look at it. We're seeing shows primarily in Las Vegas where familiarity rules the day in Las Vegas. And, you know, do you want to go into an Elton John show and see him freeform his way through,
Yes.
You know, your song or Funeral for a Friend?
Yeah.
When you come in with the expectation you're going to hear that song.
But the two ends of this are Paul McCartney, who when he does something from Sgt. Pepper's, it sounds like the record. Even if the vocal was John Lennon, Paul does a John Lennon impersonation. You know, Paul is just put on the record, and that's what you got with Paul. And it's all being played live. I don't think Paul's doing any tracks at all. All playing live and all perfect. Then the other end, you got Bob Dylan, which is, well, I even recognize the song that I know he's doing.
Well, going back to the Prince show, this is the one thought I have about that, because I saw him, I think, three times at the Rio and at his jazz show afterward. Yeah. And every time it was close to sunrise by the time I left that building. It was a very heavy duty experience and long, but he was doing a preform performance, which included his hits inside an unbroken jam. So that's what I found interesting about it. And I thought his virtuosity, but it was another thing where you had to, you know, if you were thinking you were going to go into a print show, seeing an end to end account of Purple Rain, you weren't gonna get that, you know.
Well, I obviously wasn't going for that. I didn't want the records. But on Elton John, I think what I expected and didn't get was I expected that, sure, do the song, do all the hits, do Candle in the Rain, do, you know, Rocket Man, do all of those, and do all the lyrics the way you sang them, and do the tune the way you sang it. But when it's time for an instrumental break, can't some of the guys in the band step out and do a slightly different solo?
Yeah, you know, be a band.
Yeah, you saw Cheap Trick do Sgt. Pepper's,
yeah,
right?
A few times.
You were at that show.
Yeah,
I
was impressed by all the sitarists they found.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did we have eight sitarists?
No, they were Las Vegas, were they?
I don't know. I was impressed by the quality and quantity of the sitar players. I'll just say that. I don't know if they're all, they couldn't have been all from Las Vegas, but I liked that show. I did like it.
I did too. But I mean, I was talking to them backstage afterwards. They were talking about how incredible it was that you couldn't do a good guitar solo. You had to do that guitar solo. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that guitar solo wasn't good. I structured it wrong.
But
you couldn't do a good guitar solo. You had to do that good guitar solo.
Well, they added their own songs at the end of that show. to get loose a little. I wasn't lost on me that they played a few Cheap Trick numbers too.
But it would see there wasn't Cheap Trick songs in the original Sgt. Pepper's.
No,
it wasn't even in the internal groove.
No, you play the internal groove forever, and you'll never get to it.
It never.
I want you to want me is not on there.
Never.
But I thought that was a cool. I thought it was a cool. Effort. Really, you know,
I was in the wonderful position of meeting George Martin.
Yeah, same.
Mm-hmm. And I met George Martin right after I'd seen Cheap Trick's Sgt. Pepper's.
Right.
So I said to George Martin, it was a great thing. I said, George Martin, you know, they're doing Sgt. Pepper's note for note, exactly, Cheap Trick and some other guys. They're doing it exactly Sgt. Pepper's. And George Martin went, why? Which is
I love it.
The only question to ask. And then he said, We couldn't do it live. We never did it live, never close to doing it live. Why would you do that? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, they were just trying. He goes, well, you have the record or you do music. Why would you? And I went, it's like building a ship in a bottle. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is really hard. That's why we're doing it. George Martin went, oh, okay.
And there's an appetite for it. I mean, it's the same reason you do the Love Show. You know, there's an appetite for Beatles content to begin with. I had a chance to interview him and Giles together, mm-hmm. which I think was it was certainly the last interview, maybe the only one they did together. Uh-huh. And it was at the Love Studios. And that was a really a great experience. But at one point he mentioned the talk about tribute bands, and he said he liked the tribute. George Martin said, if you're going to do tribute, do a tribute up to between 1962 and 1966, those songs in that set list, the live songs, then you're doing something that has actually been accomplished.
Right.
You're not getting a virtual reality version of it if you're going to be a band. And I thought that was very interesting for him to say.
Yeah, because otherwise you have to use tape.
Absolutely.
You have to use that stuff because they weren't performing.
Yeah, that was the whole point of it, was that they weren't performing live. It was an ode to.
And it was, you know, as Brian Eno said, it was when the studio became an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, it's all moved to laptops.
Yeah, you don't even need a studio. Yeah, I get it. But yeah, that.
Now, when bands like the, I haven't seen them live, when the Chainsmokers and stuff like that play in Vegas, are they just playing computers?
You know, let me think if I've seen Chainsmokers. I think I have, and they're going off the console. They're going off the turntables on this.
Right.
On the
There's
set.
No keyboard at all.
No.
Not even a keyboard.
No. They're hitting their laptop applications to make the melodies, and they're off the turntables. They're not playing an instrument.
Right.
Typically, yeah. I think I've seen the Chainsmokers, and that's speaking of lip syncing, there's been an accusation. This was, I forget which artist it was, who was said to be, in effect, lip syncing as a DJ. And I'm like, what is the point of that?
Well, with Paula Abdul, they had the guy in the cat suit.
Oh, yeah.
Scat over stage left. And he was pretending to DJ while it was coming from the booth. So we have had lip syncing DJ,
but I think that was understood that he was lip syncing, wasn't it? I'd have to go back and really revisit that show. But, you know, the first version of that show, you were at the formal opening, right? The very first, the soft opening of that show, I went to, and things were so out of sorts that before the show could come on stage, they were working on stuff, and Scat Cat came out to do his pre-show thing, and they figured out that they had to delay the show, but he was already out there doing his thing. He spent, I think, an hour of crowd work. This man needed a stretcher at the end of the night. I mean, he was trying everything to extend and extend so she could finally come on.
Well, you probably noticed that Penn and Teller show try to run a pretty tight ship. If we have a 9 o'clock show, not often we go up past 9:03.
Mm-hmm,
you know, we like to hit on Broadway. You know, they told us we had to hold 7 minutes, and we went up 8:07. I mean, we try to backstage, and they're never, I believe, except for the time Teller got locked in his dressing room in L.A. and couldn't get out in order to do an escape act.
Oh my God! Really? Did that happen?
That's happened.
It's like when Gilligan got delayed in an airport one time.
Yeah, yeah. It was fabulous at the Wiltern Theater. Teller, we were opening with a Straitjacket Escape, and Teller could not get out of his dressing room, and that delayed our show for 10 minutes. Well, that's, they sent people through the suspended roof to lower it down with tools to get him out of his dressing room. It was. And we had to hold the show another 5 minutes because I could not stop laughing. I was choking. I was on the floor. I couldn't stand up. I kept saying,
"How long ago was this?"
Well, when we played the Wiltern, Jesus, that would have been the first Broadway tour. So early 90s.
Okay.
Early 90s.
Damn.
But other than that,
that's brutal.
I believe they've never waited for Penn and Teller. But there have been ups at the box office, and there have been long lines at the bar. Now, Jonesy, who is a phenomenal piano player, goes into a double-time version of Caravan with a walking bass in the left hand with a full stride.
Okay.
And it is physically demanding. It's the big buildup. He's going there. He is going until Bert flips on a light that says he will finish that chorus and then introduce Penn and Teller. Now, there have been, if we're going to go late, someone crawls out from the wings and says to Jonesy, while he's playing, we'll be going up a few minutes late. And then Jonesy holds off when he goes into Caravan, so he builds up the crescendo. But there have been nights when he started Caravan, and then backstage, we were told that the bar was backed up, and we were holding 8 minutes.
Oh,
and
man.
At that point, Teller and I and the whole crew run to the wings, because it's the greatest thing in the world to watch, because Jonesy's not been told we're holding. The light will go on any second to tell him to introduce us. We know it's not going to go on for 7 minutes.
Oh, man.
And the Jonesy's now at full tempo, full build, full crescendo, and he's going to hold there for 7 minutes. It is, I mean, never mind Scat Cat.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is a guy who's been told he's doing a 100-yard dash, and they change it, and now he's running a mile.
Yeah, yeah. At 95 yards, and the ribbon starts backing up.
The finish line's coming. Yeah, really.
It's really coming. It's just the greatest thing in the world. You know, next time you see the Penn and Teller show, just hope. Maybe you can up. Maybe you can say Katz is not ready. He said to hold the show after he started Caravan, so you can watch that. Because Jonesy's then back, like, you know, soaking his arms. And Jonesy's trying to pull it back together after that. He will do key changes. He's got to keep the audience interested and also not collapse.
Uh-huh.
And it's a wonderful to see that balance. It's very rare. Because when we say we're going up at 9:03, we're going up at 9:03, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the greatest thing in the world. And, of course, we're just laughing out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And we're laughing at his horrible discomfort.
I'm sure he handles it with great aplomb.
Have you met Jonesy?
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Liar.
I know.
You don't ever handle anything with aplomb?
That's why I say that.
Yeah.
I want to ask him about it, but I got to block off some time. Because I know it'll take more than 7 minutes to get through that story, right?
Perfectly said. Perfectly said.
I love him. I love
him. What a pleasure talking to you, man.
You too, man. I'm, as you know how I feel about you guys. It's a pleasure to be in your company.
It's just great to have you in town.
That closes out another episode of Podcats. Thanks again to Penn Jillette and Michael Godeau for joining us. Thank you to Frankie Moreno for our theme song, The Biggest Cat in Town. Keep up with me, or try to, on the Review Journal website, or at Johnny Katz on Twitter, at JohnnyKatz1 on Instagram, and tune in next Monday to the next installment of Podcats. Well, it's a jungle out there, baby, and I'm the biggest cat in town.